She would work hard to become independent, to find a path out of this fearful no man's land in which she'd been marooned. Lily slept off and on, and aside from pauses for food, gas, and restrooms, the aviator drove straight through. He hadn't exaggerated. The estate wagon had a powerful engine that, when fully engaged, let them fly past nearly everything else on the highway. Their route took them far south of the Grand Canyon, which was just as well. She couldn't have seen much from her perch. They picked up and lost radio stations along the way like Hansel and Gretel's breadcrumbs. Lily learned that a slew of hijackings had been orchestrated by a group demanding the liberation of Palestine. "Is there any good news?" Lily asked, and the aviator found a station that played Neil Diamond's Cracklin' Rosie, Eric Burdon's Spill the Wine, and a really sappy song called Patches. When Dean Martin came on singing My Woman, My Woman, My Wife, Lily was instantly flooded with regret. What was she doing leaving Las Vegas? She was running away when she should stay and face things. She was losing her plush world of martinis and high rollers, sophistication and glamour, and exchanging it for what? Who knew? She picked up the fur coat, and despite the September heat, buried her face in it. The last thing she wanted was for the aviator to know her wretchedness, to think that she didn't appreciate what he was trying to do for her. But misery was gaining on her. "How about some classical music?" Jerry suggested, and the aviator obliged. Lily sank back into the pillows, listening to a soothing Chopin melody and trying to distract herself by thumbing through the issue of Newsweek the aviator had bought for her. The cover pictured a joint, smoke curling from the tip, and it posed the question, "Marijuana, time to change the law?" Fat chance, Lily thought. She laid aside the magazine and closed her eyes, overcome by memories of Javier's lacy days of San Francisco. The hippies with their ribbons and embroidery, their bare feet. The smell of eucalyptus leaves and the fecund bay. How could he have lulled her into belief in him? A belief so strong she'd been willing to risk pregnancy. Admittedly, Javier hadn't had to work very hard at it, given her growing misgivings about her life in Vegas. But still, to think of the fantasy she'd so readily bought, hook, line, and sinker. Drifting behind closed eyelids, she tried to decide if Javier's actions amounted to purposeful, conniving manipulation. He'd strewn her path with pretty petals of lies, but how much had he planned? How much was effortless, simply part of who he was? Was he a natural liar? A natural thief? Had he ever intended to live with her in San Francisco to make a family with her? Had he cared for her at all? He hadn't carried her pain for her. He'd multiplied it like breeding bacteria. She shook her head. All those things he'd said. She'd believed him. Why was her vision so imperfect, so horribly nearsighted? The old saying was true, wasn't it? Actions speak louder than words. Love is not a thief. Love does not bruise and serially, finally abandon. Love doesn't lie. He hadn't loved her. The very thing Javier did to her was what native peoples feared would happen if they were photographed. He took her soul captive. Until now, the nebulous haze of hospital morphine had kept her from feeling it all. And even now, in many ways, it still didn't seem possible or true that she'd become a veritable buffet of crippled loss. Maybe it would take months, years, or a lifetime to feel all of this, to understand. Not to understand Javier. She was determined not to give him any more of her time or energy, but rather to comprehend why she'd done what she'd done. What she needed now was to learn who Ruby, Lily, reawakened, really was. She opened her eyes to watch the sky peeling away from the back of the car. It was almost painfully absurd that she was forced to stare relentlessly at her past. In the distance, A solid brick of clouds appeared to Lily as though someone had taken the handle of a paintbrush and drawn it through the whiteness like a plow, creating a stark furrow of bright blue sky. It was, she thought, creation through removal, like a sculptor subtracting stone to reveal shape and form. Her whole life felt like a welter of subtractions. Her family, her innocence, her dream of being a real dancer, and now her savings were gone. She could forget design school, at least for the foreseeable future. And she would not dance again. The surgeon had been quite clear, even predicting that her legs would be permanently misshapen. How on earth could she support a child? She'd be 22 in several months, but what skills did she have that would help her earn? She put a protective hand to her belly. It wasn't the child's fault his father was a deviant. The child had hung in there, survived her flight over the car, and her raucous tumble down the street. The heartbeat beneath Lily's palm was that of someone who wanted to live, to be born, maybe even to dance. But to do it alone? In her head, she heard Diana Ross singing Love Child. Things were changing, but there was still a huge prejudice against unwed mothers. And she wasn't going to be living in permissive Vegas anymore, as Ruby Wilde. No, she was, once again, Lily Decker. Jerry was surprisingly strong for her size. It's from swimming, she said, helping Lily into the wheelchair and maneuvering her into a stingy gas station restroom. Lily could only imagine how unwieldy and heavy she must be with two huge leg casts, but Jerry never complained. In Winslow, Jerry and Lily sat in the sun while the aviator went inside a diner to get them burgers and fries. That man's a gem, Jerry said. He's perfect. Lily lifted her face to the sky. She was beginning to realize how good it felt to breathe clean, fresh air, to be away from the neon clutter of the strip, and not to have to worry about sunburns or tan lines. I take it you've known him a long time. Since I was a little girl. Well, he cares deeply about you. I mean, that man's devoted, Jerry said, pushing one of her springy strawberry blonde curls behind an ear. Lily guessed Jerry was in her mid-30s. Her freckled hands were bare of any wedding ring. Does he know? Lily asked. About the pregnancy? Yeah, he does. Okay, then, Lily said. They both turned at the sound of the door banging. Let's eat, the aviator said, motioning toward a picnic table lodged beneath a pathetic excuse for a tree. With obvious effort, Jerry wheeled Lily across uneven gravel. Sparrows quickly grew bold and dropped from the tree's lower branches to scour the ground for crumbs. Lily watched them, indistinguishable bits of brown and black, hopping here and there. It had been ages since she'd watched birds, since she'd luxuriated in the sun or lingered anywhere that included much of the natural world. I didn't realize how much I've missed this. Lily looked toward the sun traveling low in the sky and softened by a skim of milky clouds. Just being outside feels heavenly. I believe that nature is essential, the aviator said. Everything supernatural is in nature. Are you a transcendentalist? Lily smiled. Devotedly so. You'll find a very long shelf of transcendental writings in our library. Books. Lily smiled at him. In many ways, books represented their most precious link to each other. You have to eat, the aviator said, noticing that she'd left her burger untouched. Because I'm eating for two, she asked. He stared at her from behind his dark green sunglasses, and Jerry abruptly volunteered to go inside to get more napkins, despite the obvious pile sitting in the middle of the table. I don't really know what to say. The aviator dipped a French fry in a puddle of ketchup. There isn't anything to say, I guess, Willie reached for one of his fries. I don't know if abortion is legal in New Mexico. I haven't had occasion to know, he said, his true feelings still hidden behind the dark lenses of his sunglasses. Lily looked past him to a small grocery store that advertised a sale on pork chops and fresh roasters. A woman wearing a flowered house dress and pink sponge curlers was coming out of the door, carrying a brown paper grocery bag in each arm. Do you ever hear anything about my Aunt Tate? Lily asked.
Maybe you know your uncle had a massive heart attack. About a year ago, I think it was. I didn't know whether I should tell you, and then I decided you'd ask if you wanted to know.
Dead?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm not.
He carefully folded the paper that had covered his burger and pulled a handkerchief from his pocket. It was perfectly pressed, with knife-sharp creases. You're still fastidious, Lily smiled. He smiled back at her, refolded the handkerchief, and then said, You'd be a much better parent. A loving, caring, thoughtful parent. If that's what you're worrying about. They didn't set the bar very high. Someday, he began, and then stopped as Jerry approached.
Someday what?
Lily asked.
Just someday, he said cryptically, unwilling to go on with Jerry seated at the table.
The aviator stood and walked to the station wagon. Lily watched his erect back, his faultless posture. She realized his carefulness was camouflage, his carriage a perfect cloak for his well-pressed secrets. There was a lot, she thought, that the aviator kept hidden. But would he ever share those secrets with her? Arizona's petrified forest was eerily beautiful in its desolation. Lily gazed at the colors whirring past and thought about Aunt Tate, how she would be as a widow. Would she still sit on the couch and watch television at night? Uncle Miles's empty recliner next to her, a silent, obstinate memorial? Or would she have taken hold of her newfound freedom, rearranged the furniture, painted the walls, begun an evening class in tatting? Maybe she'd sold the house and moved into a nice apartment where others did much of the work for her. Or maybe Aunt Tate roomed with one of her Bible study sisters, ate mashed potatoes and fried chicken for Sunday dinner. Lily didn't feel hatred for Aunt Tate. She didn't feel anger, not anymore. She felt pity. Pity for a woman who had lived such a truncated, tight-fisted life. A woman who'd allowed herself such minimal love, who'd foregone passion. Aunt Tate had been absurdly loyal to a man who didn't begin to deserve her devotion. Had she ever really seen him? Known him for who he truly was? Had she worn blinders throughout her marriage, or had she felt that she had no other viable option, no means of escape? Love is blind, Lily thought, and then immediately, good Lord. She was criticizing her aunt for the very thing she'd done. For nearly a year, Lily had loved a man who was unworthy of her. She'd failed to see his mutinous heart. Well, Aunt Tate hadn't paid the price Lily had. But then again, she'd paid a different price, hadn't she? Maybe we all pay a price, Lily thought. Maybe love is always costly. She thought of Uncle Miles's shrouded raspberry bushes, lined up like the ghosts of murdered children. She thought of the ghost of herself and realized she didn't know who she'd been before Uncle Miles, who she was during. She didn't know who she was now, either. They passed into New Mexico, winding through the vast desolation of the Navajo Reservation and Gallup's Red Rock formations. After the sun set, they stopped at a line of malapropos, stuccoed plains Indian teepees, and bought one last tank of gas and used the restrooms. Jerry begged a little extra time to peruse the tacky gift shop for arrowheads and moccasins. And while Jerry shopped, Lily and the aviator lingered beneath adamant stars.
How are you doing? He asked, leaning against the station wagon's paneling.
Truth? Lily said, keeping her face toward the India ink night.
Yes, always.
I feel naked. I know that sounds bizarre, coming from someone who makes her living parading around on a stage in a state of decided undress. She cast a smile toward him in the dark.
So explain it to me.
I think it's because this is all so intimate, she said finally. I mean, we don't know each other that well. You and I, not really.
She pushed on before he could disagree.
And now you're seeing me helpless, not even able to go to the bathroom by myself. I'm completely dependent, physically, financially. And you've seen my folly, my ruin. She sighed. Does it get more intimate than that?
He'd kept his eyes focused on the heavens, as if by doing so he could lessen their mutual discomfort. But now he looked down at her.
I can't pretend to know what you're feeling, he began. But I can say that I know what it's like to feel exposed.
That's what we have those awful dreams about, isn't it? The dreams in which we're naked, walking down some hallway with everyone pointing and staring.
It's true. One of our greatest fears is in being seen without the safety of our costumes, of being revealed for what we really are, right?
So the experts say.
But Lily, I want for you to know you can trust me.
Oh, hell.
He slapped his thigh in frustration.
Just as soon as I say that, I realize how ridiculous and empty it sounds.
You must feel so little trust for anyone at this point.
Actually, she said, reaching from her wheelchair to touch his arm.
He squatted so that his eyes were on a level with hers, and she continued,
I trust you more than anyone else on the face of this earth.
Then, feeling oddly emboldened, she added, and I love you.
Sweetheart, he said, leaning across the arm of the wheelchair to kiss her cheek.
You are so loved.
He smelled of perspiration and that old, familiar citrus aftershave. Lily was tempted to think of him as a soft blanket in which she could wrap herself. At the same time, she felt the stirrings of her old adolescent longing for him, his physical attraction. The aviator stood and looked one last time at the emerging night.
You and I, we met under some very different stars.
His voice was solemn, sepulchral, and she had no response. He cleared his throat.
Over there, he pointed. The bright one. That's Venus. Venus rising in the night sky. It's the only planet named for a female, you know, he said, placing a hand on her shoulder and squeezing. And she's no easy, dull female. Venus is alive with storms. Lightning shot clouds of sulfuric acid. They think she may even have cyclones.
Lily tried to picture Venus's storms, and then she thought about trust. She remembered that as she stood on the precipice of her bus trip to Vegas, the aviator had told her to trust no one. His advice had been prescient, and yet she had to trust someone. How else to negotiate the rapids of life? Her error was in trusting the wrong person. That was more than obvious now. Her compass was broken. But she trusted Rose's father, and then Rose, Vivid and Dee, even Evan Brashear and Bob Christensen. The aviator, now. Those people were not mistakes. The mistakes came when she fell in love. That's where her instruments failed to register properly. She'd so purposefully, obstinately defined the context in which she saw Javier, choosing to see him as her rescued, wounded creature, rather than someone bent on using her. But why? What led her to fall so hard for him that she refused to see? When they were moving again, she could glimpse the night sky from her makeshift bed. She was tired of thinking. It was exhausting, this fruitless, circular analysis and puzzlement. Maybe it was the painkillers that muddled her thought process, blurred all the edges. She shifted, trying to loosen her caftan, which had become bunched up beneath her. Vivid had given her two caftans that could easily be slipped over her head. They were a paisley flurry of bright colors, and one had gold piping circling the belled sleeves and hemline. Vivid had ensured that Lily was a very fashionable invalid, although her hair definitely needed a trim. After over 8 hours of driving, they came to what the aviator called Nine Mile Hill on the western outskirts of Albuquerque. Twisting to look out the windshield, Lily managed a brief glimpse of the jeweled lights of Albuquerque spread along a broad valley, a great, hulking backdrop of mountains, and a fat moon hoisting itself up and over the peaks. 2. The main house was a 100-year-old, low-slung adobe with sensuous, undulating walls that were nearly 2 feet thick in places. A sunroom with a red brick floor had been added to the south side of the house, its windows filled with wandering vines of pink bougainvillea. 2 bedrooms contained heavy, carved wood furniture. A 3rd bedroom had been made into a library with built-in bookshelves lining all 4 walls, a generously sized Persian carpet, and a chestnut-brown leather couch with matching chairs. The hacienda even included a small indoor swimming pool, around which swooped 2 dozen relentlessly cheerful yellow, green, and blue parakeets. Jerry and Lily were staying in what the aviator referred to as the casita, a separate, modern guest house set back behind the hacienda. The casita was larger than Lily's Vegas apartment, with 2 bedrooms, a full kitchen, and pantry area, a bathroom with a walk-in shower, and a living room. The plastered walls were the color of melted chocolate ice cream, and generous windows opened onto a view of the Rio Grande and the cottonwoods that rimmed the river. From her bed on that first morning, Lily spotted a roadrunner stalking lizards in the leafy debris beneath a peach tree in what the aviator referred to as our orchard. Our was the operative word. Because on that first morning, sitting in the aviator's kitchen and being served a breakfast of French toast and fresh strawberries, she'd met Jackson Jack Powell. At 6'3", he was a big man, powerfully built, who nevertheless gave the impression of being an easygoing teddy bear. He wore tattered blue jeans, a loose-fitting Mexican shirt of thin vanilla cotton, and despite Albuquerque's early autumn heat, Birkenstock sandals with socks. His mussed, light brown hair flew in every imaginable direction. He had pale blue eyes and a pronounced Fu Manchu mustache. Jack made them all breakfast and then settled in beside Lily. She could smell the cinnamon and vanilla he'd used for the French toast. As he poured a generous flow of maple syrup over his toast, Jack looked up and caught her staring. He smiled and said, "I told him not to say anything until you got here. About us, I mean." "I," she began, at a loss for words. What did he mean, us? She looked between the 2 men. The aviator sat across the table in a baby blue, crisply ironed Oxford shirt, the sleeves rolled to his elbows. A crease was pressed into the legs of his khaki pants, and his short hair was, as always, carefully combed. Lily looked at the angles of his fingers as he held his silverware, the way he cut his French toast into precise rectangles, the way he tried to ensure that each piece soaked up an equal portion of maple syrup. And Jack, the crow's feet at the corners of his eyes, the light emanating from his features, the promise of nurturance she saw there. She tried to comprehend the yin and yang of the 2 men. They weren't living together to save money. It was clear that wasn't the case. But that was it, wasn't it?
When the aviator looked up from his breakfast plate and smiled across at Jack, Lily saw it. She saw the aviator's shoulders relax, his jaw muscles loosen. In that brief moment, she could see they were a couple, that they loved each other.
"You didn't know," Jack said, reading her expression and grinning widely. "Don't fret, Lily. No one knows."
He looked across the table toward the aviator.
"For obvious reasons,"
he added, still gazing across the table. Lily saw the aviator's cheeks color, and he looked down, focused on slicing a strawberry into four pieces.
"I just..." Lily tried again. She laid down her silverware. How could she have missed it? The aviator was a homosexual.
She said it to herself several times over, trying to take in yet another dose of the elixir of Lily's eternal blindness. They hadn't had homosexuals in Kansas when she was growing up. Well, certainly no one she'd known. She'd met some effeminate men in Vegas, especially in the costume design rooms, but it had never entered her mind that the Marlboro Man aviator was... Oh, God. This was insane. He'd had that petite girlfriend, that Jackie Kennedy wannabe Lily had seen at the Tada fundraiser. Lily couldn't take this in. Buying time, she took a sip of her fresh-squeezed orange juice.
"This is delicious," she managed.
"It's a truly lovely feast, Jack," Jerry added. "Do you want to tell our story, or shall I?"
Jack asked the aviator. "Go ahead," the aviator said. "I think you're better equipped."
"Ah," Jack said, accepting the aviator's dodge without comment. "Well then, the Ballad of Sterling and Jack."
Lily had almost forgotten the aviator's real name, Sterling Sloane.
"I was hired to give a training at the Air Force Base," Jack began, his gaze alternating between Lily and the man seated across the table from him. "To a bunch of cocky test pilots," he said, grinning. "I'm a psych professor at UNM, the University of New Mexico, and I was told that these fine men needed to learn about stress reduction."
He picked up a strawberry, bit off the top, and dropped the remainder in his mouth.
"Sterling and I had lunch afterward, and we got to talking. Primarily about chess, as I recall. The strategies of warfare, more generally, yes?" he asked the aviator.
"And you challenged me to a match," the aviator said, his eyes softening, a corner of his mouth rising with humor.
"We discovered that we both love books, philosophy in particular, antiques, a nice glass of port," Jack said.
"Quiet contemplation," the aviator added. "Emerson, Thoreau."
"And each other,"
Jack said, without embarrassment. Lily looked down into her lap. She felt a fist grab hold of her heart and squeeze. She tried hard to calm herself, to hide her confused feelings.
"I already owned this house," Jack continued, "and then we added the guest house, so that if the federal government chose to check on Sterling in connection with his security clearance, we could easily persuade them that he lived as my tenant in the guest house, not here with me."
"Lily?" the aviator said, clearly worried. "What's wrong?" Lily shook her head. She was losing again. Another removal. Now she'd lost the aviator. And yet she knew that she was being horribly selfish, wanting him all to herself. She felt as if she couldn't breathe.
"I've been an idiot," Jack said, scooting his chair so that he faced Lily in her wheelchair.
He cupped her shoulder in his hand. "Lily," he said softly, as if he might frighten away a skittish horse.
"I didn't do this well. Not at all. I've been insensitive."
She shook her head. "No, it's not you, Jack. It's me." She was still unable to meet anyone's eyes, and so instead stared steadily into her lap.
"You've had so much to deal with in such a short time," Jack said. "Too much."
"Jack," the aviator said, "why don't the three of us go talk in the library? No offense, Jerry."
"None taken."
I'll earn my keep, get the dishes cleared, she said, standing.
The aviator came around behind Lily's chair and took hold of the handles.
Okay? He asked, and in response, Lily took her napkin from her lap and set it beside her plate.
Jack opened the library's French doors, which looked onto a small, flagstone patio with an old stone fountain. Shadows flickered across the stones, and birds dipped into the fountain's waters.
There's no air conditioning, Jack said. The house is too old, but these breezes help.
I've had to be careful. Still am careful, the aviator said, sitting on the end of the couch and facing Lily in her wheelchair. My career depends upon it. If anyone found out, I'd be tossed out of the Air Force. Actually, I'd be prosecuted, criminally.
But you had that girlfriend, Lily said, her hands gripping each other as if in prayer. The one who looked like Jackie Kennedy.
Oh, you mean Judith.
No, Lily, the aviator said. She was my beard.
Your what?
Beard.
You hide behind a beard. She was my disguise, in case people started to ask questions like, why isn't he married, and maybe my sister Mary would be a good match for him.
Oh.
She was a willing accomplice. Judith had her own reasons for wanting to throw people off the scent.
Lily had projected all of her longing, her need, onto the aviator. She'd made him into her answer to loneliness, to the lack of a loving family. She'd seen only what she wanted to see, a man she could trust, love.
I guess I just always pictured you a certain way, and now I'm finding out I was wrong about you, too. I've been wrong about every single man in my life. Jesus, I'm a complete idiot.
But you weren't wrong about me, he said, pulling her hands apart and holding them in his own.
You know I care about you. You must know that. And Lily, I've just had to be very, very careful. Jack has tenure, but I don't have any protection. If anyone asks, we say I live in the casita, which means I can't even answer the phone in the main house, because then someone might figure it all out.
He'd do anything for you, Jack said, from where he'd come to stand behind the couch, a literal backdrop to the aviator.
Sterling has talked about you from nearly the first moment we met.
Hell, there was a point where I was even pretty jealous, he said,
and Lily thought she saw Jack resist resting a hand on the aviator's shoulder. The stack of Playboy magazines she'd seen in the casita, they had to be a prop. How hard it must be for them, she thought. They couldn't acknowledge their love. They couldn't hold hands across a restaurant table or as they walked down the street. They couldn't use any of the endearments other couples used without thinking. Could they even grocery shop together? Would that generate too many questions? If Jack were hurt in the hospital, the aviator wouldn't be able to touch him or show tenderness. And the names. The casual cruelty and ignorance of pansy and swish, fairy and faggot, pillow biter. She'd heard them all, never once connecting the venomous words with someone she loved. The secrets we carry, she thought. The heavy, shot-put weight of shame.
This is horrible, she said, and caught a look of disappointment on both men's faces.
Oh no, not you, she quickly added. I'm thinking about how you have to live. That you have to treat your love like some enfeebled cousin who's locked away in an asylum. I'm so sorry.
Then it doesn't bother you, now that you know about us, the aviator asked, still gripping her hands in his.
Lily lifted their joined hands and held them in the air as if she were swearing a vow.
I don't care, she said, and then thinking that she'd again put her foot in her mouth, she added, I don't care that you're homosexuals. I do care that you love each other, and that makes me very, very happy for both of you.
She looked up at Jack to be sure he knew he was included.
The aviator stood and kissed her forehead, and Jack came from behind the couch and rested his meaty palms on her shoulders.
"We're going to get you back on your dancing feet in no time," Jack said from behind her. "But you stay here as long as you like."
"Stay forever, if you want," the aviator said. "Jack and I want you here."
"I owe you," Lily said to both of them.
"No."
The aviator shook his head.
"No, Lily Decker. I owe you a debt I can never repay."
"Just tell me one thing," Lily said, wanting terribly to lighten the atmosphere in the room. "When did you stop smoking?"
"Jack made me. I told him I had no desire to lick an ashtray."
Lily blinked hard. More unbidden intimacy. She tried again.
"And the parakeets are Jack's, right?" She smiled.
"They make an unholy mess of the deck," the aviator said, confirming her suspicions. He grinned widely at his lover.
"I'm trying to loosen him up," Jack said, bending to pretend whisper in her ear.
"Someday, I'll get the crease out of those pants."
"Ha!" the aviator scoffed. "And I'll get you to put your gardening tools away."
They sparred just like any couple, Lily realized.
"Do you two need a referee?" she teased, thinking that maybe, just maybe, she'd landed in a real home, a place that would hold her gently, securely. The weeks that followed fell into a pattern. Doctor's visits, physical therapy, exercises, and more exercises. The aviator reported back to duty at Kirtland Air Force Base, and Jack spent his days at the university, with a good deal of free time in between classes at home, where he cooked, cleaned, and gardened. He even made peach jam, ladling the sweet, rose-gold preserves into mason jars that he carefully labeled in black ink.
"Have you always liked to cook?" Lily asked, watching Jack work from a sunny spot she'd found at the table.
"Always,"
he said, licking sugar from his fingers and then rinsing them in cold water.
"Do you want a taste?"
"Absolutely." Lily accepted a teaspoon loaded with jam.
"Wow,"
she said, feeling her mouth fill with saliva.
"Nectar of the gods."
Jack sat down opposite her, sliding the morning newspaper out of the way.
"My little sister and I cooked together. We baked cakes, and I actually got pretty good at making roses."
He mimed, slowly squeezing an icing bag with both hands, and Lily burst out in laughter.
"You have a salacious sense of humor,"
she said, grinning widely.
"Don't tell Sterling."
"I suspect he knows."
"Oh, that he does," Jack said, grinning back at her. "He just prefers that I not do it in public."
"You wouldn't."
"With a few martinis in me, I would
have,"
Jack confirmed, his eyes narrowed by his smile.
"I remember once there was a 9-inch pepper grinder."
Lily burst out laughing again.
"Jack, I'd like to go out on the town with you. Ever been to Vegas? Oh, we'd have a blast. I mean, maybe you could be yourselves there. Could you, do you think?"
"No,"
Jack said, shaking his head, suddenly serious.
"Not even there, my sweet."
They were quiet a moment, and Lily could hear the vibrant, hopeful chirping of the budgies drifting in from the poolside.
"I grew up in Nebraska," Jack volunteered. "My father was a farmer. Corn."
"So we're both Flatlanders."
"Oh, honey, don't I know. Talk about mind-deadening."
"It must have been hard," Lily said. "Growing up there, I mean..."
"Mostly I was confused. Horribly confused. Not about whether I liked men or not. That I always knew. More about why I was that way. What I could do about it. I will say this."
Jack picked up the newspaper sections and ordered them like some puzzle he needed to solve. "It pretty much guaranteed that I'd never believe in God. Not a God who did that to me, who made me something to be despised."
"Your parents?"
"I'm banished, shunned."
"Oh."
Yeah, my sister, on the other hand, she tries. She married a dairy farmer, as uptight and conservative as they come, a Barry Goldwater man, for God's sake. But she loves me, and we share a lot of memories. I used to help her climb out of her bedroom window so she could go to dances. Do you see her at all? We talk on the phone. That's pretty much it. And only when Drake is out in the barn or something. That's awful. It is. But it's also better than nothing. He finally stopped fiddling with the newspaper. And what about Sterling? She asked. Well, Jack smiled across the table at her. He has you. He's pretty much always had me, Lily said. In a way, I don't think we've ever been apart. At least not in my head, my heart. She touched her fingertips to her breastbone. He's always been right here. Right here. There's nowhere else he'd rather be. Of that, I'm certain. The estate wagon turned out to be Jack's, which solved that puzzle for Lily. Far more in character was the aviator's burgundy soft-top Camaro with black upholstery that seared bare skin in the strong autumn sun. He often wedged Lily's wheelchair into the back seat and took her for drives out along the western edges of Albuquerque, on traffic-free stretches of an old highway that paralleled the interstate and let him open up the throttle. They rocketed across impossibly sparse ranch land, dotted with yucca and cacti, alongside remnants of extinct volcanoes and billboards advertising Acuma Pueblo, the sky-high Indian village. In the men's shadowy, hushed library, Lily read as voraciously as she had when she was a child. She knew she'd found sanctuary with Jack and the aviator. And while she sometimes missed the charged pace of her Vegas life, she could sense that for once she was exactly where she belonged. She read some of the aviator's Emerson and Thoreau, found that numerous passages resonated with her. She could see what meaning they might have held for the aviator, too, who'd underlined a passage in Emerson's Nature. In the woods, we return to reason and faith. There I feel that nothing can befall me in life. No disgrace, no calamity, leaving me my eyes, which nature cannot repair. Lily hoped it was true that nature could repair her the way Emerson and the aviator believed, or hoped it could. Still, she found that she preferred fiction, and when she told the aviator, he smirked and handed her a copy of The Scarlet Letter. Oh, very funny, Lily said. Hawthorne was a transcendentalist, you know. You'll have to read about Brook Farm. The hippies aren't the first to try communal, utopian living. Nathaniel Hawthorne lived in a commune? Keep reading from that shelf, he pointed, and you'll see. But be careful. It's a topic that Jack can't get enough of. He'll go on and... Will I now? Jack said, coming into the library. It was their traditional after-dinner reading hour, a time when Jerry tended to borrow a car to do her own thing, which apparently consisted of yoga and folk dancing classes. I thought maybe tonight we'd have a little opera, Jack said, going to their shelves of record albums and pulling out Puccini's Tosca. Do you enjoy opera, Lily? She was secretly cringing, thinking how much she'd prefer Crosby, Stills, and Nash or Credence. I know so little about it, she said honestly. Jack's on the board of the Santa Fe Opera, the aviator said with evident pride. It's set in Rome, in 1800, Jack said, placing the vinyl on the turntable. He blew across it to remove invisible dust and lifted the arm, keeping the needle suspended over the first track while he spoke. It has all the drama you could want, torture and murder and suicide. And some of the most beautiful arias ever written, the aviator added. Visi d'arte, Jack said. I lived for art. I lived for love. They listened for 2 hours,
the men sipping their glasses of port, Lily drinking apple cider. To her surprise, she was enchanted by the music, raised up and sent spiraling by the melodies and the singers' exulting or cascading emotions. Jerry came in toward the end, flushed from whatever exercise class she'd attended. She stood behind Lily and rubbed the aches out of Lily's shoulders and upper back. When the music ended, the four of them let the silence spool out. Finally, Jack stood to lift the needle.
"This opera season is over, but next summer, Lily, next summer we'll take you up to Santa Fe. It's an outdoor theater. You'll sit in the cool night air, and if you're lucky, there will be an electrical storm flashing in the distance. You'll see fabulous scenery and costumes, and hear world-class performers."
Jack held the box for the LPs in his hands, his thoughts elsewhere. But what Lily heard had set her heart racing. Costumes?
"Magnificent costumes, innovative designs," Jack said.
"Oh," she sighed, "that's my dream."
"You've already worn some of the best, I would think," the aviator said.
"To design costumes, did you see when you were packing up my apartment?" she asked him.
"Skimpy costumes?" he joked.
"My sketchbooks with my designs."
He smiled. "I'm teasing. Yes, I saw your sketchbooks, along with your watercolors. Quite a pile of them, as a matter of fact. Vivid made a point of paging through them with me before we boxed them up for the U-Haul. Your passion was evident."
"Passion, yes, but I don't know if I have any talent. And besides, dance has defined me for so long. I mean, I've just always been a dancer in my heart, you know? And now I'm not sure who I am, who I can be."
"Then you've defined yourself too narrowly," Jack said,
his voice kind but authoritative.
"First of all, you're young. Second, we're all more than just one thing. Sterling is more than a test pilot, a great deal more. Jerry is so much more than a nurse. And you, my dear, while you're no doubt a fine and talented dancer and a great beauty, you are far, far more than that."
Lily felt tears begin to well in her eyes. "I'd planned to go to design school. I'd been saving for it."
"You still can," the aviator said. "I've kept your college fund."
"Which you're spending now," Lily said, looking down at her casts.
"Stop," the aviator said, and the stringency in his tone surprised her.
"Just open your hands. Receive. Let me do this without a fight."
"Save your energy for your recovery," Jack added.
"Which is going along so well," Jerry chimed in. "It helps to have a patient who's motivated, and who is in such great physical shape to begin with." They all let it go after that, for which Lily was grateful. But this concept of receiving, it created an enormous dissonance within her. Lily was torn. She wanted to be cared for, to feel safe and protected. But that meant she'd have to let someone take care of her. She wasn't at all sure she could do that, but she was more than willing to try.
3. Lily liked to wheel her chair into the pool area, where she'd sit listening to the calming brush of the water against the pool tiles, the pump cycling off and on. She felt herself soothed, bathed in the thick warmth of humidity tinged with the clean scent of chlorine. The parakeets would abruptly stop singing when she entered, their hush telling her that she was, at least for a few moments, an intruder in their private world. She liked to wait for them, to watch for when they tilted their heads in response to a call from a bird outside the windows, and then to listen as they replied to that free bird's voice with such strident optimism. This Saturday morning, she was watching the aviator swim laps. Not surprisingly, his strokes were crisp, purposeful. She gazed at the water streaming along his sides, the white froth of his kick.
He finished his habitual mile, which seemed to be composed mostly of turns at either end of the small pool, and then he shunned the ladder, instead easily pulling himself up and out using only his arms. Lily handed him his towel. "You have a beautiful body," she said without self-consciousness, merely as someone appreciating a lovely creation. "Shall I tell Jack that you've been flirting with me?" Over the course of a couple months, they'd grown easier with each other, able to tease. He pulled a patio chair close to her and sat, dried his legs, and then draped the wet towel across his shoulders. "Jack says you were brought up Quaker, in Pennsylvania."
"I was."
He used the back of his hand to remove a drop of water that had traveled from his hair down his neck. "They do that silent worship thing."
"They do."
"And they're nonviolent?"
"Yes."
"Conscientious objectors, right?"
"Right."
"So, what did your parents think when you joined the Air Force?"
"They objected."
"Even to World War II, to Hitler and all?"
"They object to violence across the board, and war is violence, no matter the impetus."
She wanted to ask if his parents had also disowned him for being homosexual, or if they'd disowned him for going to war, which came first, or if they'd disowned him at all.
"We've had a rough go of it," the aviator volunteered, "but we keep trying. We keep talking to each other, sporadically."
"They know about Jack?"
"They know about Jack."
"And me?" Lily asked, surprising herself with her frankness. The aviator stretched his toes, flexed his feet to stretch his calves.
"They know everything," he said.
"The crash?"
"Yes."
"So, do you mind my asking?"
"About?"
"What they think about you and Jack."
"Well, it's interesting."
He paused, gathering his thoughts. "They actually sent me a copy of a statement made by the Society of Friends in Great Britain in 1963.
And?
It said that any act that expresses true affection between two individuals and gives pleasure to both individuals did not seem to them to be sinful.
Really? Wow.
It's called Towards a Quaker View of Sex, and it says that the fact that an act is homosexual does not, by itself, render it a sin.
That's amazing. And your parents sent it to you?
Which must mean
that they continue to wrestle with it, that they want to understand.
They sound pretty cool.
They are. He smiled at her. So, now it's my turn to ask a few personal questions.
Okay, Lily said, wondering what might be coming.
Have you made a decision about the pregnancy?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I have made a decision.
And?
I'm going to keep it. She caught a quick flash of relief, maybe even joy, in the aviator's expression. Still, she could tell that he was trying hard not to influence her.
This is a child, she said, quite purposefully placing a palm over her belly,
who has determinedly clung to life. I have to respect that. And it feels like, so far, my life has been a long string of subtractions. This baby is a plus.
She finished, feeling long-winded. It felt good to say out loud the conclusions she'd reached alone.
It felt good to have someone to tell, to escape the isolated rumblings of her head.
What about him, Javier?
He doesn't matter.
You're certain?
We could try to find him for you. Lily shook her head. He's out of the picture, and that's where I want him to stay.
All right, then, the aviator said, standing. I need to shower. Do you want to stay out here longer, or shall I wheel you back in?
Wheel me, Lily said, feeling like royalty. And then let's tell Jack over lunch.
He'll be ecstatic.
And frankly, he'll also be a fuss budget.
That's my prediction. The aviator circled behind her and began pushing. Lily reached a hand across herself, placed it on top of the aviator's, and kept it there in steady, wordless gratitude. Lily took delicious afternoon naps, and beneath her caftans and loose-fitting cotton shifts, her pregnancy began to show. She ached for Javier, for what she'd imagined him to be, what she thought she'd had with him. But she'd talked herself into so much with him, reasoned away his unpardonable flaws, and trumpeted the virtues she'd strived to discover in him. She'd mistakenly believed that her childhood method of dealing with the world, her stubborn, scallywag determination, was the way to make her relationship work. But now she realized that as an adult, she had more options than sheer obstinacy. True strength, she concluded, came from knowing when to change direction. Stubbornness was not the same as strength. And strength came from wrestling with the past's wounds, just as she was doing, just as the aviator and Jack did. Javier hadn't mustered the fortitude to do more than give lip service to overcoming his father's brutality. Instead, he repeatedly succumbed to the reflexive temptation to hurt her, to lash out every time he felt vulnerable, every time he was fearful. By contrast, Lily felt the beginnings of pride in herself, for what she was trying to do with her life, for how much she'd already accomplished and overcome. The aviator took her to a bookstore in a shopping mall close to the foothills of the Sandia Mountains, and Lily chose 3 volumes from the motherhood shelf. Ever the good sport, the aviator even endured a fabric store, where Lily's wheelchair didn't fit down narrow aisles, and he had to ferry bolts of cloth back and forth for her approval. She cut out patterns for maternity tops and daydreamed about the baby blankets and tiny outfits she'd gather in preparation for the birth. The obstetrician gave her a due date of March 1971, and the aviator didn't dissuade the doctor when he assumed that the aviator was Lily's husband. It weighed on Lily that the child would be expensive. Giving birth would only add to her existing hospital bills. But the aviator assured her he wanted to do this, and she was trying to unclench Scallywag's stubborn, independent fists. As for Jack, he was beside himself with glee at the thought of being an honorary grandfather. "I will dote and dote and dote," he told Lily over dinner one evening. "And Sterling will be silly and talk baby talk. Which means that you, Lily Decker, you will have to be the disciplinarian," Jack winked. It was October, and Jerry was flying back to Vegas in the afternoon. In just 7 weeks since her arrival in Albuquerque, Lily had progressed to 2 far less bulky walking casts, and crutches had replaced the wheelchair. She could now take care of herself successfully, alone. She'd even managed to paint her own toenails and shave her legs above the casts, a bit of grooming she never expected to enjoy so much. The 4 of them were seated on the flagstone patio off of the library, eating fruit salad and Jack's cheese souffle, watching Albuquerque's skies. The early morning temperature was perfect for the flight of hot air balloons, and several of them touched down briefly in the shallow waters of the Rio, a baptism ritual for first-time passengers. The balloons were wonderfully cheerful, with bright colors and varied patterns, and when the burners fired, they roared like dragons, setting off dogs for miles around. "It's my favorite time of year," the aviator said. "The skies are a deeper blue, and the cottonwoods are just starting to turn."
"Perfect temperatures," Jack added before going inside to change the record.
In a few minutes, Kay Starr's voice drifted their way.
"I shared a magazine with her," Lily grinned, "but I had the cover."
"Really? What was it?" Jerry asked. The casinos have those weekly newspapers. They put them in the hotel rooms and around town. Maybe you've seen them, she said, directing her comments.